Welcome to Every Horror Movie on Netflix, the show where we watch, review, and discuss every horror movie on Netflix. I am Chris, and I'm here once again with Patrick.
Hello.
And Steven.
Hey.
And we have returned after a pretty lengthy recording hiatus. You probably noticed the release hiatus. Everything's fine. We're okay. but we're happy to be back in person and to talk about Revenge of the Pontianak. That's we're all struggling with the pronunciation of the demon in this Malaysian film, right?
Yeah. Singaporean Malaysian film.
Yeah. Of this Malaysian film, so just bear with us on that, but we're here to discuss that. That was the pick of the Wheel of Death last time, but before we get into that, we like to do a little horror catch-up and talk about what else we've been consuming, reading, watching in the space since the last time we talked. So, what have you guys been up to? What's going on? What's spooky?
You know, yes. It's funny, I have so little to talk about, even though it's been so long since we've recorded. But the warmer months are coming here, so I'm watching and consuming less horror. But I did see Late Night with the Devil, starring David Desmalchian, in theaters. It was a really good time. You've probably heard of it by now. It was quite buzzy, even months before it came out. And I'm sure you've been involved or have heard debates about its use of AI, which is really interesting.
Let's not talk past it, because I heard about this. You brought this up to me, and then I started hearing about it like on our Discord and other places, and everyone seemed to be familiar with this, but I've never heard of this out in the wild, except for I saw it on the movie listings when I was looking at showtimes for Civil War, which I didn't go see.
Yeah, me either. I'm going to try and go next week. Yeah, so I'll set it up a little bit. This was really buzzy out of South by Southwest, I think. I mean, I don't expect you to have heard of it, because I read like the horror trades multiple times a day. So this, I'm just inundated with this shit, to the point of exhaustion sometimes. But this stars David Desmalchian, who most people know as a character actor. He was in the Dark Knight and the James Gunn Suicide Squad. He was the polka dot man. Really fantastic actor with a really interesting backstory before he got into acting. Check out his Fresh Air episode if you want to learn more about that. But this is set in the late 1970s. He's a late night talk show host, like a Johnny Carson, maybe even more of like a Dick Cavett style late night talk show variety host whose ratings are in the toilet. He's trying to save his show, so he decides on Halloween he's going to host a live exorcism of a young girl. And it's pretty much takes place in real time. It's presented as found footage, which works to varying degrees of success. And you basically see the broadcast as it happens. It does cut away sometimes for commercial breaks and to black and white. And you see what's going on sort of behind the scenes as he's having conversations with his producer. And there's lots of sort of ethical considerations going on about should they really go through with this exorcism or not, because weird shit starts happening on the broadcast, and it's all shot to look like a 70s television broadcast to really great effect as well. I'm somebody who leaves on old episodes of Dick Cavett late at night while I'm working on things, so I'm a sucker for it. Desmalchian is incredibly charming. It's quite spooky. It does everything that every possession movie does. That literally checks all the boxes, and you guys know that's my least favorite genre, but it adds a fun little twist to each little incident that occurs throughout it, and it had me completely gripped. I think it's a fantastic movie, up there with the WNUF Halloween special. I think I'm going to watch it every Halloween. I can't wait to see it again. But the controversy is the set design department used artificial intelligence for some of the interstitial artwork, like "we'll be right back," you know, how on late night they always have those kind of like punchy little graphics, you know, and they're Halloween themed in this one. I had known going into the film that there was AI used in some component of the production of this, and had I not, I wouldn't have guessed, but since I knew that those were the bits. I could just tell right off, these don't look... They work. You see them for 2 seconds at a time, but they don't quite look like they were designed by a human. You know, the skeletons, we all know AI can't really do hands still, so the skeletons have too many fingers, or the fingers look weird. There's just something off about it that I thought kind of contributed to the uncanniness of the entire project. But upon zooming out and talking with some other folks, like, I know this is a low-budget movie, but they're also kind of putting people out of work by using these techniques. It seemed to be a cost-cutting measure. And it was actually, the use of AI was more prevalent than I knew at first, even after, upon reading about it, because I later saw an image of, he has these, the host has these, or this like sliding door that he walks out to onto the stage, and it has like a, his show's called Night Owls, and there's a picture, like a painting of a skyscraper at night with an owl on top of it. And I didn't notice it watching the movie, but if you look at a screen grab, the windows are all over the place, like in like a nonsensical, unorganized fashion, the way that an AI image would be created. So, and that's a pretty prominent set piece in this film that you see throughout all of it, and it's a large piece, you know, it's a gigantic sliding door. So, I don't know. I don't think that, that doesn't ruin my enjoyment of the film, but I think it's interesting to debate the ethics of that aspect of it. So yeah, does it satisfy your curiosity, Chris?
It does, and I could do. We could probably have an hour long conversation on AI. I don't see a reason to do that now, and also I don't want to make the same mistake I made with COVID, where I went on a podcast and said, This is overblown. This is a passing fad. This is not going to be something that really changes how we live our lives. And then it did. So I don't want that to be on record with me expressing my dim view of AI and AI art.
At least you didn't say it on our podcast.
No, it's a complicated issue. You know, I like to think about like, what if, because I mean, I'm someone who has grown up making media amid the digital video revolution, and I'm someone who uses many technologies that put people out of work and simplified the creative process. You know, at one point, listen, if you want to make a Star Wars scroll in your Star Wars fan movie, it's like two clicks today versus whatever the hell they had to do in 1977, right? And so is that bad? Is that good? Where do we draw the line? I think there's something terrible about machines that can't think and are completely disconnected from the human experience having a hand in that, especially when they're using other people's copyrighted material as the basis of their understanding of what it means to be artistic. But like I said, we could talk for an hour about it, I guess. I don't know. What I'm saying is I won't damn a movie for using AI art, but we're at this point, but I will put the world on notice that I don't like it.
Yeah, I don't think it's like too egregious of a crime in the case of this movie, and I think it's really interesting that people caught on to it really quickly, and it instantly became a popular topic of conversation for people who are into film. So that is kind of heartening to me, and gives me a little hope that like even the average Joe can spot this stuff a mile away, and they're going to call it out, and we're going to talk about it. It's not going to take over the industry the way people are fearing, at least not as quickly as it at first seemed like it might be when it was really blowing up in the zeitgeist.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested to see. Yeah, go ahead, Patrick.
I was just going to say my concern is just that this is at such an early stage and like, yeah, we can still spot it now. But what I keep getting worried about is, you know, when even a year from now, let alone 5, 10, 15 years from now, how much worse it's going to be. I don't know. It all freaks me the fuck out is my take on it.
Relevant. And I guess I'm shooting myself in the foot because of what I just said. But I saw today that this fake James Bond trailer starring, I think, Henry Cavill got 2.3 million views and people thought it was real. So what do I know?
I saw that right before we started recording. I literally have it up in a tab to watch once we finish.
Yeah, I'm curious. But moving things along, the only other thing is I am still just barely keeping the aim on book club going on the Discord. I did actually kind of ramp up my reading a little bit today, but since this is a visual medium, we're reading Thomas Ligotti's Conspiracy Against the Human Race. He's just one of the most fascinating horror writers of all time, I think. Michigan boy. I think he lives in Florida now. He's got a great collection of supernatural fiction out on Penguin that was reissued. I think it originally came out in the 80s. This is a nonfiction book about basically his assertion based on research he did of past philosophies and also neuroscience and some other areas. His assertion that life is really just a nightmare and that we create it's a nightmare and we create an illusion of happiness and meaning in it, and that if you strip all of these ideals that we have ingrained in ourselves, you would, I don't know, perish of fright, you'd kill yourself. I'm not sure how he's going to conclude this thing, but it's pretty dark stuff. So we are taking it slowly over there as we go through it and trying to keep it as light as we can. Join us.
I feel like we could have an hour conversation about that too.
Yeah, well, we will on the Discord lounge.
I have to have read the book to participate, otherwise I'm just an asshole.
You strike me as somebody who, like me, might have pretended to read the book once or twice in school and wrote a report on it.
Well, so you can give me that impression.
You can join us if you like. You do not have to have read the material. We like to see people's faces and hear their thoughts. Patrick, what have you been up to horror-wise?
Kind of continuing on a few projects from last time, still working on my horror comic, which should be ready to release into the world in a couple months or so here. Still been playing Control, which has continued to really sink its hooks into me as I've gone along. I was telling Steven right before we recorded here that I had a little difficulty kind of settling into the gameplay early on, but I feel very fluent with it at this point and was having a ton of fun with it by the end, to the point where I am now going back and playing side missions, which I'm usually like a main campaign motherfucker. Like, I ignore side missions as much as I can, but I'm going back now playing all the silly little side missions. I downloaded the DLC for it to kind of see the connective tissue to Alan Wake. So I've really been enjoying that. And then, lastly,
we could talk for an hour about Control too.
Well, I mean, you could talk for an hour about anything.
Not easily.
I don't know if we can talk for an hour about today's homework, but
okay, that's fair. I feel like we will, though. We always say that, and then we wind up doing it anyways. But lastly, I also recently kind of impulse bought a very strange comic book called Beneath the Trees Where Nobody Sees. It's by the author Patrick Horvath, who I was unfamiliar with. But the cover art just really caught my eye because it was like anthropomorphic animals rendered in a very cute, charming, warm kind of style, except there was a lot of blood on the cover as well. So this is the first issue I picked up of a 6-part series that will be collected as a graphic novel, and it's about a town full of anthropomorphic animals along the lines of like Busy Town, something like that. And there's a bear who is a serial killer and finds out there's another serial killer in town that she starts competing with. It was very weird vibes, and I am curious to see where it goes. Loved the art. The premise, I will say, was certainly strange. I'll give it points for that. And I will read more, but I kind of reserve the right to have a full-fledged opinion on it until I read the rest, because I don't know. It's a weird one.
I'm into this. I got to read this because this looks very like Simon Hanselman, like Meg, Mog, and Owl kind of.
Yeah, I could see that for sure.
Okay, right up my alley.
Yeah, weird shit. Chris, any horror in your world these days?
Boy, let me think. I guess the highlight of my spooky life since we've last spoke was I watched a mini document. Actually, it might have been an hour and a half. It was pretty long, but I watched on Max a documentary about Robert the Doll. Either of you guys ever hear of Robert the Doll?
I feel like you told us about this.
I thought you said
time,
Robert Davi. No, I don't know what this is.
No, I don't think I talked about this.
Okay.
If I did, that's embarrassing. But,
or maybe you told me about it in person. I don't know.
Robert the Doll, the world's most haunted doll. Key West, Florida, lives Robert the Doll, a doll owned and beloved by an artist boy who lived his whole life very fond of this doll and blaming things on this doll. The doll's alive, okay? The doll's alive. And for decades, it's been creeping out people in Key West, Florida, and now it lives in a museum behind glass. Sure, we've seen this story before. True story, documentary, allegedly. But
allegedly a documentary.
here's what's interesting.
Well, it is a real doll that's in like a real museum, though. Like, you can't actually go see it.
Yeah, and here's what's interesting to me about it, because yeah, like, it's easy to say whether or not you are interested in the living cursed doll story. People believe in the curse of Robert the Doll, where if you go see Robert the Doll in the museum and you don't obey his rules, and he has like six of them, like, don't take his picture without asking, be respectful, don't do this, don't do that, whatever, he curses you. And in the museum, there is a wall with thousands of letters from people around the globe who disrespected Robert the Doll and are begging him to lift the curse and apologizing to him.
What do these curses play out like? I'm sure it's a variety, but like, what horrors do these people have to live with after?
I classify it under bad luck. People are like, I lost my job, my dog died, I got sick, I got in an accident.
Do you sound like everyday life? Things that happen to people that are unpleasant but common.
Well, listen, if you want to have that lens on it, I think you're entitled, because a lot of the stuff and a lot of the so-called Robert the Doll victims, that's what they said on the lower third, Robert the Doll victim, the people who were interviewed in this documentary, you know, some of it's normal life stuff. They're like, in the 13 years since I've seen Robert the Doll, I've lost relationships. I've lost jobs. It's like, yeah, man, that's
me
life.
Me too, bro.
13 years ago. But
it's an unlucky number, though. I mean,
God, yes, yes. Bad. And also, it's Key West. And a lot of the people who go to Key West and hang out with Robert the Doll maybe are a little down on their luck, or maybe they were going to get divorced anyway. So there's that. But anyway, but it's fascinating to me. First of all, it's just, you know, if there's a real life haunted doll, I want to know about it. But if there isn't, I thought it was interesting to see sort of the mass hysteria around it, where thousands of people are attributing their bad luck to Robert the Doll, this like pockmarked stuffed doll in a glass case.
Well, we've had some scintillating conversations about, like, you know, like Ouija boards and whether or not those of us in this group would fuck with one or not. And the responses have been surprising. After seeing the documentary, would you go to see Robert the Doll?
I want to see Robert the Doll, okay. And I would stay in Robert the Doll's house, but which is a bed and breakfast now. But
dead and breakfast.
I would probably just follow the fucking rules, because what's the upside for me of disrespecting Robert the Doll versus the infinite downside of getting diseased, breaking up, losing a job, crashing my car, losing the pet, on and on and on down the list.
Speaking my language, I think it's absolute bullshit, as I do about most cursed things, but you bet I'm going to follow the fucking rules. I'm not going to risk that shit if it is real.
Mm-hmm. Well, the rules sound reasonable. Like, you'd have to be an asshole to disobey them. Like, they're just not things that I would do to begin with, right?
Well, there's a...
Would you ask the doll's permission without being instructed to take his photo?
Yeah.
What are the other rules also?
I mean, some of them are definitely targeted towards like people who want to be obnoxious. All I can find online are Robert's Rules of Order, which I don't think they are the same thing. but like one of them is like, you have, you know, like the Ouija board, you have to say goodbye.
We need to apply Robert's Rules of Order to this podcast.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. There's various rules. Don't take his picture without permission. Don't, maybe banging on the glass, disrespecting Robert the Doll, mocking Robert the Doll, things like that. But you have to remember to say goodbye.
Yeah, that's the only outlier for me, because otherwise this sounds like sort of normal rules of a museum. You know, don't take pictures. Don't touch the glass. Don't be
disrespectful.
Yeah.
It's a creepy looking doll, though. I mean, it's a handsome looking doll.
Wait, can you get in trouble for disrespecting him, like, when you're not in his presence?
I think you have to be in the room. I think you have to be in the room.
Phew. Otherwise, how would he know? Unless he listens to the show.
God, that is a creepy looking doll. Fuck that doll.
Well, speaking of disrespecting art, what did we watch this week? We watched Revenge of the Pontianak. Now, this movie comes to us from Malaysia, and I just want to say right off the bat, I was surprised that the Pontianak is the same demon as the Kuntilanak, which we reviewed. Yeah, if you go to Wikipedia and you look up Pontianak, it redirects you to Kuntilanak, the Indonesian name.
It was Indonesia. I was like, yeah, it's probably just like a slight regional difference, slight language difference.
I don't remember anything about Kuntilanak, but I feel like the mythology around it was quite different, right? In the movie, at least.
Kuntilanak was about kids in like a cursed mirror. Like, that was the thing. There was like a Kuntilanak mirror. Yeah. But I think a lot of the tropes are the same. Like, long-haired woman in the mirror who lost a child or something like that, etc. So, anyway, I thought that was interesting. We're building our knowledge of lore here.
What did you put in the chat, Patrick? What am I looking at here? This looks like pornography.
I was looking up Robert the Doll, and there's this guy who like did a like queer art project about Robert the Doll, and there's like this cute Twinkie boy dressed up in costume as Robert the Doll. So I figured I'd share that with you all.
Yeah, sorry for the interruption, but that I was shaken when I opened the link, so we'll have to include that in the show notes.
We got different algorithms, that's what I'll say.
Imagine that.
Anyway, so yeah, Revenge of the Pontianak. This is we open with a wedding and a handsome man getting married to the love of his life. He has a little Moppet son who is his son but not his bride's son. We learned that early on because he comes up and he's like, hey, and he's like, you call her mom now. We're married or something. after the festivities, they begin to be haunted by an apparition of a beautiful, sometimes terrifying, other times woman who is raising hell in the village, raising hell with the people who are at the wedding, and just generally causing mayhem. And why is she here? Why does she want revenge? What can our ostensible hero do to stop it? That's the film.
Here's what I'm going to say about that. We did not mention, I blanked out for a second, that there's an opening text that tells us what a Pontianak is. And as soon as I watched the first 10 minutes of this movie, I successfully predicted most of what happened and what the sort of mystery of this creature was. And yes. I don't know how you get around it, because I needed the explanation, you know, but I imagine if you're from Malaysia and you see this film and you know that it's about a Pontianak, you're drawing the same conclusions because you already understand what that is and how these things come to be. But it almost feels like a spoiler, like we have no episode if we say what a Pontianak is at this point. You know what I mean?
It's kind of the, you know, it's we bring this up every so often. It's kind of the X-Files factor, where on those X-Files episodes where you see what Scully and Mulder are going to take 45 minutes to find out right at the beginning, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we could talk about what the Pontianak is, and then the spoiler is whether or not she gets revenge.
Yeah. Although, I mean, spoiler alert,
it's in the title.
Well, but also, like, there's definitely some surprises in how it's gone down. I mean, the fact that, like, this man clearly has a woman with another child, you can guess pretty quickly who this Pontianak is and what her relationship is to him. But there are some surprises as to how that all happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and without, you know, we'll obviously talk about this in the spoiler room, but upon reflection, like, there's a surprise that contradicts the definition that this film presents us of what a Pontianak is.
Yeah.
Well, what's the definition? What's the definition that the film presents at the beginning? It's basically the title card.
If a if a woman dies with child or during childbirth and is not given a proper burial, she comes back as a vengeance-seeking demon. I may have a false memory that they use the word vampire.
I think it did say that, yeah.
I okay. think it did say vampire, well. And the Netflix description certainly says vampire.
Okay, okay.
The so Netflix description, I think, was written by someone who watched the first 5 minutes of the movie and said, I get it.
And, like, hats off to them.
Right? Yeah, hats off to them, because they mostly got it. But, yeah, so, I don't know. But, like, that with that opening title, like, I think, again, like, this is obviously something that people who live in Southeast Asia are familiar with, this legend, mm-hmm. right? So it's like us going to see a Wolfman movie. We know the deal. Like, and it's not really a surprise. And then I think the plot of the movie kind of came together as maybe like sort of a morality play, where it's like, it's sort of like a fable. It's like, here's a story that you've probably seen and heard your whole life. And here it is. We're telling
it on
film.
Well, I was poking around on IMDb and reading reviews from, it seems like, folks who are native to Southeast Asia, if not specifically Malaysia, who were saying, I saw a number of reviews that said this is a great revival of the Pontianak genre.
Well, so let me add some helpful context, I think, that I literally just learned on Wikipedia. But one of the two directors of this is, like, a big fucking deal. The Wikipedia describes him as one of Singapore's leading film and theater directors. He was the artistic director of the first Asian theater company to be established in the UK. He's mostly a theater director, it appears. His resume is pretty crazy, actually. But he created this film as, at least according, again, to Wikipedia, an homage to the popular Malay horror films produced by the Shaw and Cathay Studios in Singapore back in the 1950s. Mm. So that's kind of interesting to me. He's also gay, which I feel like plays into some shit that happens later in this film. Or at least some of the ways that this film shot down what I expected to be kind of a toxically masculine narrative.
But. Yeah, I found it interesting too that he's done all this. He's won tons of awards. He played the titular role in Madame Butterfly with Anthony Hopkins.
Holy shit!
And then he winds up to make this. What an interesting career!
That's crazy.
Well, I thought the movie was very well produced. I'm not surprised that the guy's one of the leading figures in there, because it's there's production. I mean the.
Hold on, one final detail that's fascinating to me. He directed the first Singaporean film to achieve a worldwide commercial release. That's interesting.
Was it this one?
Sorry, no. It was Forever Fever, which is apparently relating to Saturday Night Fever in some way. Hmm. Came out in 1998. Hmm. Sorry, anyways, I interrupted you. I just wanted to share that one little other tidbit.
Yeah, it's all good. But it looks like there's still some parts that like are reminiscent of these other low budget horror movies that we watch, but I thought the cinematography was above its weight for the most part. And like mm-hmm. the special effects were above its weight for the most part. So it doesn't surprise me that the guy's a actual filmmaker of some note and not just a guy. So yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. That brings up something that I had kind of a disorienting experience watching several scenes in this movie where I was like, okay, this looks great. The cinematography is pretty definitely above par for some of the kinds of films we watch on the show. But the editing and blocking was odd. And when I learned that he mostly works on the stage, I was like, oh, well, that makes sense that would be a shortcoming of his. Like, there's scenes where, like, characters are walking in the wrong direction of where they should be spatially to what's going on. There are a couple of scenes I had to, like, rewind to be like, wait, what happened? And wait, who's in this scene? Oh, they're, like, all the way across the village in another room, but it's cutting to them and then cutting back. Like, there's a little bit of confusion there that makes sense for, like, a, you know, somebody who's only made a couple of lower budget movies. I can forgive all that, but
yeah, I did not track that at all, actually.
Well, I kind of just want to explain what the problem is here, at least a little bit. Maybe not explain the crime, but obviously, as we all knew within the first 5 minutes of the movie, this ghost is the ghost of our hero's ex-lover who he had his child with, and she died. The circumstances of under which she died are not explained until late in the film, but she's back and she's angry. What's she angry about? We don't really know until we get down the stretch, but like, obviously it would bother anybody that your ex took your child and
didn't give you a proper burial.
And I guess didn't give you a proper burial is the most important thing. So she's back and does she kill? Who does she kill? She kills the one guy at the wedding who we find out more about later.
The guy's like best friend who has been away for a while.
Okay. He was the one where I couldn't clock the relationship.
I thought it was a, okay. It all makes sense. Actually, this is a masterful film.
I liked this a lot, actually. Yeah.
Because you say that like, you said like his best friend who's been away for a while. And I was like, wait a minute. That doesn't make sense with what I read, how I interpreted him early in the film, but no, it's just, there's layers to it.
He picks up a chick at the wedding and I don't remember who she was.
He didn't remember who she was. He didn't remember her name,
but we get kind of I was thinking of the classic, you know, campfire story, The Hook. We basically get that. That's the first Pontianak kill. It's the Hook, lady. But it's like, yeah. Yeah, they're basically driving off. He's trying to get fresh with her in the car and they're about to basically go to might as well be Lover's Lane, and the Pontianak descends upon the car and causes them to crash, rips him out. He winds up in a tree like a predator victim in the village later. And that sets off this massive like hysteria and conspiracy theories and gossip. Mm-hmm. Right? Who dies after that?
Our main character Khalid's, I think it's his, is it his brother or his best friend?
It's his brother. Yeah, that one I figured out.
His brother's pregnant wife's child dies.
Right.
In a pretty hysterical sequence that I actually didn't quite understand what had happened until it was over.
The one that I had to rewind first. I was so confused about who was who and where was, yeah.
Well, because the Pontianak is possessing various people and then everybody's just screaming and finally it turns out that the child has died. And I wonder if they maybe needed to obscure it for some reason. Because I rewatched it myself and I don't think you would understand that unless you hear the dialogue in the following scene when you see them like over a child's grave.
Exactly, right? I was like, that feels like a kind of self-censorship, maybe.
Yeah, I wonder if there is some censorship issue where you can't show a miscarriage or something. I don't know.
Even though the so funny that they made a movie about a Pontianak, but they couldn't show the miscarriage.
Anyway.
Who are the other major players in this movie? We've got kind of spiritual guy in the town. He's the Jay of the movie, for sure.
He's
the Jay.
It's also similar to Jay. He kind of seems like a weird, possibly bad dude at first, and then it turns out he's got some pretty good ideas. Mm-hmm. He knows what he's doing. He knows what he's talking about. He has a cool hat.
He brought some entertainment value into this for me.
Mm-hmm.
Stock character, you know. He's like the holy man who, when he sees everyone's out in the streets looking at the guy strung up in the tree with his guts hanging out, and they've all brought their kids to gawk upon it, and he shows up and he's like, I know what this is. It's a Pontianak.
Clean your house.
Clean your fucking house.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. He's points fingers too. He's like Jordan Peterson. You're like, clean your room.
Yeah, you want to scare me? Tell me to clean my house. That was my thing.
Yeah, no shit. I'd rather the Pontianak got me than I clean my house.
And then exactly. when the fetus dies, he's like, "You didn't clean your house. This is what happens."
Mm-hmm. Told you to clean it, bitch. Come on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, fantastic. And there's like weird stuff going on in the village. Kids are getting sick with everybody's afflicted by this thing, which is, I don't know, kind of interesting. Like, there's sort of a communal aspect to the horror that we don't get, I think, with our like legends and stuff, where it's like, oh no, you did the bad thing, you're cursed, but also like you've brought despair to your broader community in a more vague way.
I'm trying to remember, like, what happens from there after the fetus death.
Things just mount. It gets into melodrama pretty quickly. We learn a lot about the past that we probably don't want to get into.
Oh, yeah. Pretty are we in a, yeah, probably spoiler room, you know, territory already.
But, yeah. Well, yeah, what else is there to say? Fuck. See, we're rusty already.
We're rusty. We've been away for a while, but we're, yeah, I don't know. You want me to review it? I'll go first. I'll keep this show running along.
All right, yeah, let's just review it, and I'm sure we'll discuss some other aspects of it through that. Steven, you seem very eager to tell us if you would view it, cue it, or screw it, Revenge of the Pontianic.
I'm going to give it a screw it. There were some things that I admired and appreciated about this movie, though. I mean, I thought this, we talked about the direction, and, well, not the direction so much. The cinematography is really good. The costume design is really nice. The set design, I like the look of the village, which did look perhaps like maybe it was, it had to be a set. I don't know, because this was set in, it's a period film. I don't know. 1965, I think.
Oh, yeah, which yeah. I didn't realize until three quarters of the way through the movie.
Yeah, me either. But yeah, no, it looks nice, and there are a few surprises here and there, but, you know, like we were saying, this is a movie that, you know, unfortunately, this is the nature of folklore sometimes, I guess. It kind of gives itself away at the beginning, and I didn't find the answer to the mystery satisfying. It felt like it was actually kind of, it tried to surprise us in a couple of cheap ways that weren't ultimately effective for me. I thought, there's not a character to hang a fucking hat on in this movie except for Jay. Like, these people don't have interests, they don't have lives, they don't have personalities. It's all melodrama all the time, to the point that, like, we had trouble figuring out what some of the relationships were between the characters, right? Like, is that a friend or is that his brother? Or, I don't know.
I just missed a line of dialogue, to be fair. That was my confusion there.
Yeah, but it could have been reinforced with behavior, you know, of the characters, and it wasn't. I don't know. It just felt, the whole thing felt very thin to me. It wasn't particularly scary. I think it goes a little, I mean, it's entertaining, but it gets pretty stupid at the end and becomes, well, we'll talk about what it becomes. Yeah, ultimately, I could not in good faith recommend this to someone unless they were a completist of Southeast Asian horror films. And then, you know, you probably should see it. And there's probably other films about Pontianics. We know there's at least one about a Kuntianic that you can compare and contrast with, and maybe if that's a term paper you have to write, check this one off your list, but otherwise steer clear. Chris, what did you think? View it, cooter, screw it.
I will also give it a gentle screw it. I just didn't think there was a lot here. It's like, sure we've seen this before. The tropes of the Pontianic seem just so uninteresting and familiar to me. And then also the filmmaking, which I don't want to be ethnocentric about, but it seems like it borrowed a lot of, like, Western tropes. It felt like an Insidious movie at times. It kind of reminded me of, like, 1920 London, you know, it was kind of fun in that respect. Cause I was like, okay, the filmmakers here are like, this is sort of a greatest hits of things that you see in horror movies and the way it's shot and everything. But it was just tropes on tropes on tropes, I thought, and nothing really interesting. A mystery that's a foregone conclusion. Characters that just seem to be... It's like being read a bedtime story, and I don't fault it for that. It just wasn't my sort of thing. Like, it was just sort of two-dimensional characters who are just kind of retelling this well-worn tale with sort of a blunt, well-worn moral to it. And, you know, no, I don't hold any malice in my heart for any of these people, but it's just, would I watch it again? No. Am I glad I watched it? Also, no. Patrick, you liked this movie, so let's end the reviews with some positivity.
I did. Would you view it?
Screw it. I know you're not going to screw it, right? You're not
gonna I'm going to give it a gentle view. It actually kind of a soft view. This really grew on me as I went along. It came a long way from the awful looking title card, which I feel like was probably grafted in there somewhere along the way and had
another
to
thing
do
that
with
reminded
the
me of Insidious.
Original vision.
A little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, Timu, Insidious. But I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the performances, actually. I really liked the lead character. He was very, engaging to me, and made some of the twists that came later feel a little extra shocking because I felt fairly invested in this guy by that point. I liked the third act stuff. I mean, like, yeah, we know this is going to be a woman who died in childbirth, and as we talked about, like, that was, you know, it's pretty obvious that she's probably this dude's ex some way or another, but two other shockers that came up along the way worked for me, and I actually really liked the ending because it did not go where I thought it was gonna go. Overall, found it pretty enjoyable.
All right. Well, before we go to the spoiler room to spoil all the twists and turns of Revenge at the Pontianak, let us remind you that you can find us on social media in between episodes. We are at AmonCast on all platforms. Also, we have a lovely Discord community that you should be a part of. That is linked to in the show notes. Our people get together and talk about everything. You can be in Steven's book club. We like to hear what you thought of the movies. You can also go to our website, everyhorrormovieonnetflix.com. It's a little broken. It's a little rough around the edges, but hey, aren't we all? Aren't we all? So you can see a partial list of the movies we've reviewed. You can also go to our merch store and buy a mug or a shirt or what have you with Every Horror Movie on Netflix art on it. So with that said, we're going to head down to the spoiler room and spoil everything about Revenge of the Pontianak in just a few seconds. Stay tuned. All right, welcome back. We are down here in the spoiler room, getting ready to spoil everything about Revenge of the Pontianak. And before we do that, I just want to give a little shout out to a listener named Frank, who sent us an email during our little hiatus, thinking we were dead, worried, sick, that something horrible had happened to us. And I tried to respond to Frank, but our email is just as broken as our website. So I just want to thank Frank for the concern and for trying to check in. But we are okay. We're doing great. Unlike some of the people in this film who once the Pontianak comes to town, listen, don't be fooled by the beautiful red dress. It's not, I don't know where I'm going with that one, but she's spooky. She's spooky. And I mean, she gets her revenge, right? She goes on a rampage and basically tries to kill everything, everyone. She likes to take on the disguise of other people, maybe your loved ones, but you know, it's her because she's doing the little itty hee laugh with her fingers up in her face, which is not what your friends do. I mean, it's okay if they the people in this movie don't do that until they're possessed. That's what I'm trying to say.
Oh my god, when she possesses the brother, that's where I was like, oh, he did play the director did play Madame Butterfly. Maybe he's gay, because this feels very queer coded to me. Like, we know it's her possessing him, but that is like perhaps the gayest performance I've ever seen in a motion picture. It was delightful.
Yeah, I mean, I forget if this is before or after the big reveal of what all has actually happened, but they organize a mob to chase down the Pontianak, and they have to stab her with a bolt.
In the neck.
In the neck, which is kind of brutal.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Very vampire adjacent, right?
And I'm not sure if bolt is like a direct translation, because the thing they're trying to stab her with looks more like a spike than what I would think of as a bolt.
Like a letter opener.
Yeah. But when I first heard bolt, I was imagining like a thick, like a literal bolt.
Like a cow, like with a bolt gun, like if you're a cow.
Sure, yeah.
Hashtag go vegan. Hashtag go vegan. Anyway, what were you imagining?
Oh, I mean, I was just imagining like Frankenstein's monster or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Like a big ass bolt.
Literal like construction bolt.
I mean, a little bit of false advertising because I was paying real close attention to see if she was a vampire or not. And I don't think the evidence is there that she's a vampire. She definitely does eventually, like, I guess, drink some blood and eat some meat, eat some people. But vampire?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. And when she's eating that meat, it looks like she's doing something else. But we'll get to that moment when we come to it.
It's like one of those like modern vampire movies that are ashamed to be about vampires. So they're like, those vampire legends, those are just legends. But vampires are real. But they don't suck blood. They just eat you.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like vampire may be another translation issue. Because, I mean, she doesn't really drink blood. She's just a spirit who kills people. Like, there's certainly blood on her hands a lot of the time, but she's not out to, like, sip blood out of necks the way we think of when we think of, like, a Western vampire.
You know, every vampire, every culture in the world has a vampire legend, even cultures that never communicated with each other.
No.
You didn't know that?
Is that true? Or are you trolling?
I think I understand that to be true.
I think I've heard something similar. I mean, it's sort of like how like people have shared sleep paralysis, dreams, and demons across cultures, as we learned in the Nightmare.
Yeah, episode. But because it's all has a basis in truth and facts,
and not just in like humans' universal fear of existing. Which you can learn more about on the book club.
Well, I don't think it's fear of it. I mean, I think, you know, the vampire legend, oh, something with sharp teeth comes out in the night, wants to kill me. That's pretty biological fear that transcends culture, I think. Same with the Hat Man, like something with that comes at night and has glowing eyes and like something has a head that's not shaped like my head. It's probably going to eat me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm a evolutionary biologist now, anthropologist now.
Well, but we find out that the big like surprise here, or I mean the beginning of the like twist, which obviously again the first twist is she's the Pontianic is Khalid's ex, our protagonist's ex, and the flashbacks that we see reveal that she got pregnant after she left town, came back, has a baby, and there's some major political event going on when she comes back, which I thought was interesting.
I
should have dug into the history of that because I feel like it can't be coincidence that people are celebrating some sort of freedom or a revolution.
I think it's Malaysian Independence Day.
Yeah. Oh, it was like, okay. All right.
Well, and there was something about how he was ashamed of these dalliances that he had with her. He would see her on the weekends and it was not a good look for his family. I didn't really pick up on what that was.
Yeah, because he ends up telling her his family has arranged another marriage for him, I think, right?
Yeah, but even before that happened, he
which
was
I think is a lie.
Keeping her on the DL.
He's just not that into her.
I don't know. I thought about like revisiting that sequence to see if there was some subtext that I was missing, but I don't know. There may just be something culturally specific that I wouldn't immediately pick up on.
But, well, I don't know why this is a period piece.
Well, I think that's why I was so curious about what it was about, especially with that like newsreel footage that we get of the independence moment happening or whatever. I don't know. I mean, ultimately, it seems inconsequential. It doesn't seem related thematically to anything else that happens in the film.
Yeah, I mean, again, not that we would know. But it seems to be some sort of deliberate choice. Anyway, she's pregnant, and that is bad news bears for him because, again, he's just not that into her. He thought that he was done with this relationship already. So he hatches a plan with his two best buds, one of whom is the best bud who showed up at his wedding and got killed early in the film, the other of whom is his brother.
Yes.
To basically, like, take her against her will to go get an abortion. On the way there, she realizes something's wrong. They're driving way too far out of town. She starts to protest and runs off into the woods, suffers a miscarriage, and then Khalid kills her very shortly after she gives what appears to be stillbirth, which is why Stephen said before this is the kind of the technicality where she did not technically die in childbirth. She dies immediately after childbirth, essentially, because she's blaming him for the baby being dead. He loses control, strangles her to death, and then we find out the baby's actually still alive. It was not a stillbirth at all. And not only all that, but the baby she gave birth to is his little boy, who we've seen throughout the whole movie. He's still raising this kid with his new bae.
Which we knew pretty much from the beginning. It's just a matter of how it happens, right? Like, what leads to him, what leads to her death and her not being given a proper burial? And that's where it kind of frustrated me, that sort of rug pull. They're like, oh, the baby's alive. Well, like, the whole time we know the baby's alive because he has a child. We, the viewer, know he has a child. And I was thinking, like, okay, the baby seems to be dead for quite a long time. They're out there in the rain. Mm-hmm. They're talking about how the baby's dead. The baby's not moving. The baby's not making noise. And I'm like, okay, well, eventually we're going to hear it crying. But it went on for so long that I was like, this just doesn't even seem feasible.
Well,
biologically, you know. But
I don't need accuracy in that moment.
It wasn't accuracy, it just rang kind of cheap and false to me.
It's pretty horrible. I mean, we've all had to break up with people, and you know, can you imagine getting your boys together and just driving her out to the lake and murdering like that? It's terrible.
No, I can't.
I've come pretty close.
Well, listen, we're available as long as it's not a woman who's dying in childbirth.
And
I would like to clarify, I am not available for murder at any time.
You'd just be an accessory, and nobody'd ever know. And we'd give her a proper burial. Don't worry about that.
And that's the important. So that's all right. So this is the highlight of the movie for me, because I think we find this out because he's recounting it to Jay, right? He's confessing to Jay what happened, and it's a ghoulish story. And Jay's just like, and he's like, you didn't give her a proper burial. Look what you did. Because that, of course, is what creates the Ponte Lanach and curses her to walk the earth as a demon looking for revenge. But yeah,
well, that's
insult to injury, I guess.
They do bury her. We see them digging the grave. Doesn't he give some interesting cultural detail about like what a proper burial entails? Like, I feel like he asks a question. Like,
oh yeah, he didn't bless something, or he didn't have a blessed something to put on the grave, or something like that. It's like Robert the Doll.
There's he took a photo and rules. He didn't say goodbye.
Yeah. Oh damn! But yeah, that's what. So actually, I want to interject here with a little. I just found a little article written by the director of this film, explaining some of his intentions. And man, you know, I feel like I gotta take back when I said that this movie's like full of Western tropes and stuff, and I said I thought that was fun. I feel kind of bad for having said. So I'll link to this in the show notes because the whole thing is interesting. But the reason it takes place in the 50s and 60s or the 60s, I think, is because that was a time when the Malaysian film industry was booming, and the very successful films about the Pontianak were in theaters and successful. And so this is like a throwback to that. It's like making a Godzilla movie, but deciding to set it in the 50s, like the original Godzilla movie, instead of setting it in present day. But he's deliberately not trying to make a Western-influenced film, so I feel bad that I said this was full of Western tropes. I mean, it's tropes that are familiar to me, as you see them in Western movies too. Maybe it's like the vampire, and they just pop up in different cultures. But he said that younger Singaporeans are fed with a steady diet of super Westernized Hollywood films, so he wanted to tell local stories and pay homage to the great, he calls them great Pontianak films. He said these local Malay films were a beautiful amalgamation of the diverse cultures in South and Southeast Asia. Chinese producers owned the studios and greenlit the projects. Indians and Filipinos directed and wrote scripts. Malays acted in the... Or Malays, is it?
I always thought it was Malays, but I'm not sure.
Malays acted in the movies and composed music. By the early 1960s, Malays had took on the role of director too. Films during this era were embraced and beloved by Singaporeans and Malaysians. They were unique to us and our identities. So that's from the director. That's what he's doing here. It's a celebration of the horror traditions.
What really interests me is, okay, so when I was reading these IMDb reviews that seemed to be of Malaysian folks, because there was a lot of references to, like, pretty good for a local movie was one of them. They gave it, like, 3 stars. But they referred to the Pontianak genre, and I'm like, a Pontianak is a very, very specific kind of creature. And it's very specific circumstances under which they're born. How many different stories can you really tell within that? And I'm not, I'm just saying I'm genuinely curious to see what those are, because my mind struggles to think of, you know, 2 or 3 different scenarios that you could use to shake this up. Because a woman has to die in childbirth or with child and seek revenge.
Like, at least as it's described in the opening title of this, on the title card of this movie. But also we saw the Kuntilanak movie where it was kind of different and there was a haunted mirror involved and stuff. So maybe it's thing, like a djinn.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are like sort of hyper specific monsters, I feel like, in every culture. I mean, what we associate with a vampire, there's so many like sort of very specific rules and
that's true
circumstances around it that are like weirdly, just weirdly, like, I don't know why I'm struggling for a word right now, but it's just strange that, like, after all these centuries, like, we still talk about, like, garlic for vampires and silver bullets for werewolves. And I guess that's not as specific as, like, the origin story of the Pontianak, but still, it's strange how these things continue to have a hold on us over centuries after they were, like, even, like, the smallest bit relevant. You know, like, people I'm sure were, like, literally afraid of vampires back in the day, or literally afraid of Pontianaks. It's interesting how, yeah, that still fascinates us. Those creatures still fascinate us after so long.
I wish I felt that fear after having seen this movie.
I mean, maybe some of these stories are more focused on how the revenge is exacted, or how the Pontianak, you know, what the effects are after the fact. But it's like there's only so many ways you can get to a woman dying with child and being buried properly.
They made 4 John Wicks.
Touché. And they're gonna make another one.
Yeah,
and a series. There's a TV show. Yeah.
So, whatever. Anyway, so what the hell happens here? So he confesses, and then he has to confess again with the, sort of the communal aspect. He has to confess to the community. He has to publicly shame himself and come clean and be like, and he buries the lead a little bit. He's like, I'm a bad man. I'm a liar. I'm a murderer. And people are like, oh, what the, and people are just get more and more agitated as he goes along. But because the community has come together, they form a mob basically. And is it to kill him or kill the demon or kill both? I don't know. They're kind
of
like,
they pretty quickly align with him to get rid of the demon, and they let him join the ranks.
Mm-hmm.
This is my memory of it, though I did watch this a couple days ago. But I was kind of surprised by that, because it goes from like they're ready to fucking tear him apart to like, all right, you go with him and I'll go with him, and like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then the Pontianak shows up and is just flying around. It's like a, I don't even know what it's like. It's crazy.
It reminds me of the part.
Superhero powers.
It reminds me of the part in the Lost World Jurassic Park where they're all walking to the raptor enclosure through the grass, and they're all just like getting pulled down into the grass. That's basically what happens to these people.
Flies around like the Death Eaters in Harry Potter. That's what it does.
Kind of, yeah. And like a lot of the time, you don't even see her, you know. And then she suddenly like descends from the trees like a spider and punches somebody 20 feet across the. Long.
She's like exploding people like in Zack Snyder's Watchmen.
This is like the fucking prison cell scene in fucking Malignant is what this is like.
Yes, yeah.
Not as, nearly as good as that, but yeah.
No, definitely not. Just that level of
No, I saw
Unstoppable Carnage.
I referenced this earlier, and like I wish I had made this connection myself, but this did come from one of those IMDb reviews, but it resonated with me. Is it becomes a Predator movie all of a sudden, especially with like the kind of like jungle terrain with the ferns and everything, which looks super cool. But the fact that she's like operating almost invisibly sometimes and dragging people up trees and, but it's, I don't know, listener, it's not as cool as it sounds. Trust me.
It's pretty cool. I would say I enjoyed this scene. I'll say that.
It's action packed.
But he almost gets the what do they even call it? Gets the drop on her. That's a saying, right? He stabs her successfully, but not successfully enough or deeply enough, I guess, because she stands up and pulls that spike right out.
And she gets beaten up, like, I think at least one other junction, right? I remember a scene where, like, it's like Halloween Kills, where, like, all the villagers are, like, beating her ass and she's on the ground and it's like, oh, is she dead? Yeah. No. And then she does the Neo thing where she's like, ah, and they all fly off of her.
Yeah. And then she does kill him. She does.
She kills him.
Kills Khaled, the fuck and, out of him. With the spike, right? With the bolt?
Yes. Yeah. And
I say, let me say it. I'll say it. He had it coming.
He absolutely had it coming. Well, and see, this is what I was talking about earlier with like kind of the toxic masculine shit, because I was sort of assuming that this was going to take the path of, yeah, this guy did a bad thing.
I did too.
Not bad enough to justify this dumb woman spirit coming after him and fucking everybody up. But this movie is firmly on the Pontianic side in the end and winds things down with a moment of solidarity between the Pontianic and the female lead, who we haven't talked about really. Because there's not much to talk about.
Exactly.
It winds up with a note of solidarity as the Pontianic asks Khalid's wife to finally do what everyone else is trying to do to her and put her out of her mercy because she's tired of living this fucking life of being a Pontianic. And so it ends with the wife like mercy killing the Pontianic at her request. And I actually really like the ending.
Yeah, and her anger is lifted by seeing her son and talking to her son. I think the son maybe even asks her for her mercy or something. I'm not sure, but you know, that's sort of her unfinished business. She had this child, she had this love, horrible murder, and now she finally, as demon, gets to, I mean, she actually kind of was building a relationship with the son throughout the movie, because you have the stock scenes of the kid being like, oh no, that was I was talking, who are you talking to? Oh, I can't say. No, that sort of
That stuff is dumb as hell. But I loved, so she kills the brother too in the melee. He gets it pretty viciously, but there's a shot that is so funny to me. We get two irises in this movie, and like as a transition, which like that is so funny to me whenever anybody uses that. It's like such a George Lucas, like Star Wars thing to do. And like this came out in 2019. Come on, guys. But she's it's a very wide shot, and the Pontianic is on top of our quote unquote hero who's dead. And it looks like she's eating his flesh. She's bent over her behind facing the camera, and depending on how you look at it, she could be eating his flesh or she could be sucking his dick, and the iris literally closes on her ass like perfectly. And then cuts to the next scene. Did you guys catch this?
No, I didn't. No. That's not where my back, head was at.
It's not intentional, but it's so funny. Like it's like one of those great little mistakes that just like totally took me out of the experience. It made me wonder if there was something else I was supposed to be reading from the scene. But it is done with precision, trust me. If you're interested, go back and check that moment out to verify. But that's your movie, right? Yeah,
she ends with her smiling because she's finally been set free.
Yeah, yeah, and she wants her son to not have to deal with any more of this misery that has been caused by the sins of his father and all of the terror and havoc that she has wreaked in getting her revenge.
The kid is adorable, by the way.
He's a Mr. Banku of the Year candidate. Oh, yeah. Number one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not since Veronica have I seen such a Mr. Banku-esque character.
I think we might need a Spirit of Banku award as well
thought,
as a Spirit of Jay award.
I thought we had one. The way we talk about it.
What a cute Muppet. Yeah, he's great.
Oh, Banku.
Well, I hope we all learned a lesson from this movie.
Yeah. Don't try and force your partner to get an abortion and then kill them.
No, study proper burial rites is the lesson I took.
Yeah,
from
there
this.
You go.
Because you never know when you might need them.
Yeah, it's like that other. School. Yeah, it's like that other movie we watched that was all about people who were damned because they broke funeral etiquette.
The Pog Pog.
Oh yeah, Pog Pog Nine Lives. Mm-hmm. Like, this is serious stuff. I'm glad I brought up Robert the Doll. I didn't think it would be this relevant. But yeah, people got their rules, man.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that was a, South Asian movie, I think, as well? Pog Pog?
Yeah, it was.
Interesting, kind of the themes that we're picking up here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what the hell are we watching next, Chris?
Oh, it's my turn to pick. Well, you know what? Call me crazy. I think we're gonna stay in East Asia and we're gonna watch a Taiwanese film called The Bridge Curse. A group of university students decides to test an urban legend about the ghost of a female student that haunts a campus bridge.
I'll have to do some more research for that episode and tell this whole story, but I have some experience with going to bridges at night that are alleged to be haunted by people who died there.
Oh, it's based on the legend of the haunted bridge at an actual university.
I can't wait to hear Steven's story. This stuck out to me because, I don't know, the thumbnail on Netflix looks scary. It's like someone on a spooky bridge taking a iPhone photo. It might be at least partially found footage. We'll see. I don't know. But it reminds me, this legend's a plot device in film of the year, The Empty Man from a couple years ago. Because there's like it starts off with like an urban legend where there's kids like going out to a bridge and like ringing a bell and like trying to see a spooky. So
it has 4.1 stars on Google reviews, but a 32% on Rotten Tomatoes. So we'll see who we agree with, the critics or the fans.
Well, you know, they made it for the fans and not the critics.
They made it for the fans. Yeah.
So, all right. So that'll be in 2 weeks. We'll be watching The Bridge Curse. Until then, like I said, stalk us on social media on our official pages only, please. And then join our Discord. Link to that's in the show notes. We'd love to hear what you thought of the Pontianak, what lessons you learned, and if you've ever been to a spooky bridge. Until then, for every horror movie on Netflix, I'm Chris.
I'm Patrick.
I'm Steven.
See you later.
Bye-bye.